A great formless cloud of life drifted across the Discworld, like water building up behind a dam when the sluice gates are shut. With no death to take the life force away when it was finished with, it had nowhere else to go. Here and there it earthed itself in random poltergeist activity, like flickers of summer lightning before a big storm. Everything that exists yearns to live. That's what the cycle of life is all about. That's the engine that drives the great biological pumps of evolution. Everything tries to inch its way up the tree, clawing or tentacling, or sliming its way up to the next niche, until it gets to the very top, which on the whole never seems to have been worth all that effort. Everything that exists yearns to live. Even things that are not alive, things that have a kind of sub-life, a metaphorical life, an almost life. And now, in the same way that a sudden hot spell brings forth unnatural and exotic blooms, there was something about the little globes. You had to pick them up and give them a shake, watch the pretty snowflakes swirl and glitter, and then take them home and put them on the mantelpiece, and then forget about them. The relationship between the university and the patrician, absolute ruler and nearly benevolent dictator of Ankh-Morpork, was a complex and subtle one. The wizards held that, as servants of a higher truth, they were not subject to the mundane laws of the city. The patrician said that, indeed, this was the case, but they would bloody well pay their taxes like everyone else. The wizard said that, as followers of the Light of Wisdom, they owed allegiance to no mortal man. The patrician said that this may well be true, but they also owed a city tax of $200 per head per annum payable quarterly. The wizard said that the university stood on magical ground and was therefore exempt from taxation, and anyway you couldn't put a tax on knowledge. The patrician said you could. It was $200 per capita. If per capita was a problem, de capita could be arranged. The wizard said that the university had never paid taxes to the civil authority. The patrician said he was not proposing to remain civil for long. The wizard said, what about easy terms? The patrician said he was talking about easy terms. They wouldn't want to know about the hard terms. The wizard said that there was a ruler back in, it would be the century of the dragonfly, who had tried to tell the university what to do. The patrician could come and have a look at him if he liked. The patrician said that he would. He truly would. In the end, it was agreed that while the wizards, of course, paid no taxes, they would nevertheless make an entirely voluntary donation of, let's say, $200 per head, without prejudice, mutatis mutandis, no strings attached, to be used strictly for non-militaristic and environmentally acceptable purposes. It was this dynamic interplay of power blocks that made Ankh-Morpork such an interesting, stimulating and above all bloody dangerous place in which to live. Many songs have been written about the bustling metropolis, the most famous, of course, being Ankh-Morpork, Ankh-Morpork, so good they named it Ankh-Morpork. But others have included Carry Me Away from Old Ankh-Morpork, I Fear I'm Going Back to Ankh-Morpork, and the old favourite, Ankh-Morpork Malady. Senior wizards did not often get out and about on what, welcome to Ankh-Morpork, probably called the thronged highways and intimate byways of the city, but it was instantly obvious that something was wrong. It wasn't that cobblestones didn't sometimes fly through the air, but usually someone had thrown them. They didn't normally float by themselves. A door burst open and a suit of clothes came out, a pair of shoes dancing along behind it, a hat floating a few inches above the empty collar. Close behind them came a skinny man endeavouring to do with a hastily snatched flannel what normally it took a whole pair of trousers to achieve.
"You come back here!" he screamed as they rounded the corner. "I still owe $7 for you!"
A second pair of trousers scurried out into the street and hurried after them. The wizards clustered together like a frightened animal with 5 pointed heads and 10 legs, wondering who was going to be the first to comment.
"That's bloody amazing," said the Arch-Chancellor.
Said the Dean, trying to imply that he saw more amazing things than that all the time, and that in drawing attention to mere clothing running around by itself, the Arch-Chancellor was letting down the whole tone of wizardry.
"Oh, come on. I don't know many tailors round here who'd throw in a second pair of pants for a $7 suit," said Ridcully.
"Oh," said the Dean.
"If it comes past again, try to trip it up so as I can have a look at the label."
A bedsheet squeezed through an upper window and flapped away across the rooftops.
"You know," said the lecturer in recent runes, trying to keep his voice calm and relaxed, "I don't think this is magic. It doesn't feel like magic."
The senior wrangler fished in one of the deep pockets of his robe. There was a muffled clanking and rustling, and the occasional croak. Eventually, he produced a dark blue glass cube. It had a dial on the front.
"You carry one of them around in your pocket?" said the Dean. "A valuable instrument like that?"
"What the, hell is it?" said Ridcully.
"Amazingly sensitive magical measuring device," said the Dean. "Measures the density of a magical field. A thermometer."
The senior wrangler proudly held the cube aloft and pressed a button on the side. A needle on the dial wobbled around a bit and stopped.
"See?" said the senior wrangler. "Just natural background, representing no hazard to the public."
"Speak up," said the Arch-Chancellor. I can't hear you above the noise." Crashes and screams rose from the houses on either side of the street. Mrs. Evadne Cake was a medium, verging on small. It wasn't a demanding job. Not many people who died in Ankh-Morpork showed much inclination to chat to their surviving relatives. Put as many mystic dimensions between you and them as possible, that was their motto. She filled in between engagements with dressmaking and church work. Any church. Mrs. Cake was very keen on religion, at least on Mrs. Cake's terms. Evadne Cake was not one of those bead curtain and incense mediums, partly because she didn't hold with incense, but mainly because she was actually very good at her profession. A good conjurer can astound you with a simple box of matches and a perfectly ordinary deck of cards. If you would care to examine them, sir, you will see they are a perfectly ordinary deck of cards. He doesn't need the finger-nipping folding tables and complicated collapsible top hats of lesser prestidigitators. And in the same way, Mrs. Cake didn't need much in the way of props. Even the industrial-grade crystal ball was only there as a sop to her customers. Mrs. Cake could actually read the future in a bowl of porridge. It would say, for example, that you would shortly undergo a painful bowel movement. She could have a revelation in a panful of frying bacon. She had spent a lifetime dabbling in the spirit world, except that in Evadne's case dabbling wasn't really apposite. She wasn't the dabbling kind. It was more a case of stamping into the spirit world and demanding to see the manager. And while making her breakfast and cutting up dog food for Ludmilla, she started to hear voices. They were very faint. It wasn't that they were on the verge of hearing, because they were the kind of voices that ordinary ears can't hear. They were inside her head.
"Watch what you're doing."
"Where am I?" "Quit shoving there."
And then they faded again. They were replaced by a squeaking noise from the next room. She pushed aside her boiled egg and waddled through the bead curtain. The sound was coming from under the severe, no-nonsense Hessian cover of her crystal ball. Evadne went back into the kitchen and selected a heavy frying pan. She waved it through the air once or twice, getting the heft of it, and then crept towards the crystal under its hood. Raising the pan, ready to swat anything unpleasant, she twitched aside the cover. The ball was turning slowly round and round on its stand. Evadne watched it for a while, then she drew the curtains, eased her weight down on the chair, took a deep breath and said,
"Is there anybody there?"
Most of the ceiling fell in. After several minutes and a certain amount of struggle, Mrs. Cake managed to get her head free.
"Ludmilla!"
There were soft footsteps in the passageway, and then something came in from the backyard. It was clearly, even attractively, female in general shape, and wore a perfectly ordinary dress. It was also apparently suffering from a case of superfluous hair that not all the delicate pink razors in the world could erase. Also, teeth and fingernails were being worn long this season. You expected the whole thing to growl, but it spoke in a pleasant and definitely human voice.
"Mother, I'm under here."
The fearsome Ludmilla lifted up a huge joist and tossed it lightly aside.
"What happened? Didn't you have your premonition switched on?" "I turned it off to speak to the baker. Caw, that gave me a turn. I'll make you a cup of tea, shall I?" "Now then, you know you always crush his teacups when it's your time." "I'm getting better at it," said Ludmilla. "There's a good girl, but I'll do it myself, thanks all the same."
Mrs. Cake stood up, brushed the plaster dust off her apron and said,
"They shouted. They shouted all at once."
Modo, the university gardener, was weeding a rose bed when the ancient velvet lawn beside him heaved and sprouted a hardy perennial Windle Poons, who blinked in the light.
"Is that you, Modo?"
"That's right, Mr. Poons," said the dwarf.
Shall I give you a hand up?
I think I can manage, thank you.
I've got a shovel in the shed, if you like.
No, it's perfectly all right.
Windle pulled himself out of the grass and brushed the soil off the remains of his robe.
Sorry about your lawn,
he added, looking down at the hole.
Don't mention it, Mr. Poons.
Did it take long to get it looking like that?
About 500 years, I think.
Gosh, I am sorry. I was aiming for the cellars, but I seem to have lost my bearings.
Don't you worry about that, Mr. Poons, said the dwarf cheerfully. Everything's growing like crazy anyway. I'll fill it in this afternoon and put some more seed down, and 500 years will just zoom past. You wait and see.
The way things are going, I probably will, said Windle moodily.
He looked around.
Is the Arch-Chancellor here?
He said.
I saw them all going up to the palace, said the gardener.
Then I think I'll just go and have a quick bath and a change of clothes. I wouldn't want to disturb anyone.
I heard you wasn't just dead but buried too, said the gardener, as Windle lurched off.
That's right.
Can't keep a good man down, eh?
Windle turned back.
By the way, where's Elm Street?
Modo scratched an ear.
Isn't it that one off Treacle Mine Road?
Oh, yes, I remember.
Modo went back to his weeding. The circular nature of Windle Poon's death didn't bother him much. After all, trees looked dead in the winter, burst forth again every spring. Dried up old seeds went in the ground, fresh young plants sprang up. Practically nothing ever died for long. Take compost, for example. Modo believed in compost with the same passion that other people believed in gods. His compost heaps heaved and fermented and glowed faintly in the dark. Perhaps because of the mysterious and possibly illegal ingredients Modo fed them, although nothing had ever been proved, and anyway no one was about to dig into one to see what was in it. All dead stuff, but somehow alive, and it certainly grew roses. The senior wrangler had explained to Modo that his roses grew so big because it was a miracle of existence, but Modo privately thought that they just wanted to get as far away from the compost as possible. The heaps were in for a treat tonight. The weeds were really doing well. He'd never known plants to grow so fast and luxuriantly. It must be all the compost, Modo thought. By the time the wizards reached the palace, it was in uproar. Pieces of furniture were gliding across the ceiling. A shoal of cutlery, like silvery minnows in mid-air, flashed past the Arch-Chancellor and dived away down a corridor. The place seemed to be in the grip of a selective and tidy-minded hurricane. Other people had already arrived. They included a group dressed very like the wizards in many ways, although there were important differences to the trained eye.
"Priests," said the Dean. "Here? Before us?"
The two groups began very surreptitiously to adopt positions that left their hands free.
"What good are they?"
said the senior wrangler. There was a noticeable drop in metaphorical temperature. A carpet undulated past. The Arch-Chancellor met the gaze of the enormous chief priest of Blind Eo, who, as senior priest of the senior god in the Discworld's rambling pantheon, was the nearest thing Ankh-Morpork had to a spokesman on religious affairs.
"Credulous fools,"
muttered the senior wrangler.
"Godless tinkerers,"
said a small acolyte, peering out from behind the chief priest's bulk.
"Gullible idiots," "atheistic scum,"
"servile morons,"
"childish conjurers," "bloodthirsty priests," "interfering wizards"?
Ridcully raised an eyebrow. The chief priest nodded very slightly. They left the two groups hurling imprecations at each other from a safe distance and strolled nonchalantly towards a comparatively quiet part of the room where, beside a statue of one of the patrician's predecessors, they turned and faced one another again.
"So, how are things in the god-bothering business?" said Ridcully.
"We do our humble best. How is the dangerous meddling with things man was not meant to understand?"
Pretty fair, pretty fair."
Ridcully removed his hat and fished inside the pointy bit.
"Can I offer you a drop of something?"
"Alcohol is a snare for the spirit. Would you care for a cigarette? I believe you people indulge."
Not me.
If I was to tell you what that stuff does to your lungs... Ridcully unscrewed the very tip of his hat and poured a generous measure of brandy into it. So, he said, what's happening?
We had an altar float up into the air and drop on us.
A chandelier unscrewed itself. Everything's unscrewing itself, you know. I saw a suit of clothes run past on the way here. Two pairs of pants for $7.
Did you see the label?
Everything's throbbing, too. Notice the way everything's throbbing?
We thought it was you people.
Oh, it's not magic. I suppose the gods aren't more than usually unhappy?
Apparently not.
Behind them, the priest and the wizards were screaming chin to chin. The chief priest moved in a little closer.
I think I could be strong enough to master and defeat just a little snare, he said. I haven't felt like this since Mrs. Cake was one of my flock.
Mrs. Cake? What's Mrs. Cake?
You have ghastly things from the dungeon dimensions and things, yes? Terrible hazards of your ungodly profession,
said the chief priest. Yes.
We have someone called Mrs. Cake.
Ridcully gave him an inquiring look. Don't ask, said the priest, shuddering. Just be grateful you'll never have to find out. Ridcully silently passed him the brandy.
Just between the two of us, said the priest, have you got any ideas about all this? The guards are trying to dig his lordship out. You know he'll want answers. I'm not even certain I know the questions.
Not magic and not gods, said Ridcully. Can I have the snare back, thank you? Not magic and not gods. That doesn't leave us much, does it?
I suppose there's not some kind of magic you don't know about.
Well, if there is, we don't know about it.
Fair enough,
the priest conceded. I suppose it's not the gods up to a bit of ungodliness on the side, said Ridcully, clutching at one last straw. A couple of them had a bit of a tiff or something, messing around with golden apples or something.
It's very quiet on the god front right now, said the chief priest.
His eyes glazed as he spoke, apparently reading from a script inside his head.
Hyperopia, goddess of shoes, thinks that Sandalphon, god of corridors, is the long-lost twin brother of Groon, god of unseasonal fruit. Who put the goat in the bed of Ofla, the crocodile god? Is Ofla forging an alliance with seven-handed Sek? Meanwhile, Hoki the jokester is up to his old tricks.
Yes, 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 all right, said Ridcully. I've never been able to get interested in all that stuff myself. Behind them, the dean was trying to prevent the lecturer in recent runes from attempting to turn the priest of Ofla the crocodile god into a set of matching suitcases, and the bursar had a bad nosebleed from a lucky blow with a thurible. What we've got to present here, said Ridcully, is a united front, right?
Agreed, said the chief priest.
Right. For now. A small rug sine-waved past at eye level. The chief priest handed back the brandy bottle.
Incidentally, Mother says you haven't written lately,
he said. Yeah. The other wizards would have been surprised at their arch-chancellor's look of contrite embarrassment. I've been busy. You know how it is.
She said to be sure to remind you she's expecting both of us over for lunch on Hogswatch Day.
I haven't forgotten, said Ridcully glumly. I'm looking forward to it. He turned to the melee behind them. Cut it out, you fellows, he said.
Brethren, desist,
bellowed the chief priest. The senior wrangler released his grip on the head of the high priest of the cult of Hinky. A couple of curates stopped kicking the bursar. There was a general adjustment of clothing, a finding of hats, and a bout of embarrassed coughing. That's better, said Ridcully. Now then, His Eminence, the chief priest, and myself have decided... The dean glowered at a very small bishop.
He kicked me. You kicked me.
Oh, I never did, my son.
You bloody well did,
the dean hissed. Sideways, so they wouldn't see.
"'Have decided,' repeated Ridcully, glaring at the Dean, "'to pursue a solution to the current disturbances "'in a spirit of brotherhood and goodwill, "'and that includes you, Senior Wrangler.'
"'I couldn't help it. He pushed me.'
"'Well, may you be forgiven,' said the Archdeacon of Throom stoutly. "'There was a crash from above. "'A chaise longue cantered down the stairs and smashed through the hall door.
"'I think perhaps the guards are still trying to free the patrician,' said the High Priest. "'Apparently even his sacred passages locked themselves.'
"'All of them? I thought the sly devil had 'em everywhere,' said Ridcully.
"'All locked,' said the High Priest. "'All of them.'
"'Almost all of them,' said a voice behind him. Ridcully's tones did not change as he turned around, except that a slight extra syrup was added. A figure had apparently stepped out of the wall. It was human, but only by default. Thin, pale, and clad all in dusty black, the patrician always put Ridcully in mind of a predatory flamingo, if you could find a flamingo that was black and had the patience of a rock.
Lord Vetinari, he said. I am so glad you are unhurt.
I will see you, gentlemen, in the oblong office, said the patrician.
Behind him, a panel in the wall slid back noiselessly.
I believe there are a number of guards upstairs trying to free you,
the chief priest began. The patrician waved a thin hand at him.
I wouldn't dream of stopping them, he said. It gives them something to do and makes them feel important. Otherwise, they just have to stand around all day looking fierce and controlling their bladders. Come this way.
The leaders of the other Ankh-Morpork guilds turned up in ones and twos, gradually filling the room. The patrician sat gloomily staring at the paperwork on his desk as they argued.
"'Well, it's not us,' said the head of the alchemists.
"'Things are always flying through the air when you fellows are around,' said Ridcully.
"'Yes, but that's only because of unforeseen exothermic reactions,' said the alchemist.
"'Things keep blowing up,'
translated the deputy head alchemist without looking up.
They may blow up, but they come down again. They don't flutter around and, e.g., start unscrewing themselves, said his chief, giving him a warning frown. Anyway, why'd we do it to ourselves? I tell you, it's hell in my workshop. There's stuff whizzing everywhere. Just before I came out, a huge and very expensive piece of glassware broke into splinters.
Marry, 'twas a sharp retort,
said a wretched voice. The press of bodies moved aside to reveal the General Secretary and Chief Butt of the Guild of Fools and Joculators. He flinched under the attention, but he generally flinched all the time anyway. He had the look of a man whose face has been ground zero for one custard pie too many, whose trousers have been too often awash with whitewash, whose nerves would disintegrate completely at the sound of just one more whoopee cushion. The other guild leaders tried to be nice to him, in the same way that people try to be kind to other people who are standing on the ledges of very high buildings.
"'What do you mean, Geoffrey?'
said Ridcully, as kindly as he could. The fool gulped.
"'Well, you see,' he mumbled, "'we have sharp as in splinters, and retort as in large glass alchemical vessel, and thus we get a pun on sharp retort, which also means... Well, a scathing answer. Sharp retort, you see. It's a play on words. It's not very good, is it?
The Arch-Chancellor looked into the eyes like two runny eggs.
Oh, a pun, he said. Of course.
Ho, 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 ho. He waved a hand encouragingly at the others.
Ho, 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 ho,
said the Chief Priest.
Ho, 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 ho.
Said the leader of the Assassin's Guild.
Ho, 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 said the head alchemist. And you know what makes it even funnier? Is that it was actually an alembic.
So, what you're telling me,
said the patrician, as considerate hands led the fool away,
is that none of you are responsible for these events?
He gave Ridcully a meaningful look as he spoke. The Arch-Chancellor was about to answer when his eye was caught by a movement on the patrician's desk. There was a little model of the palace in a glass globe, and next to it was a paper knife. The paper knife was slowly bending.
"Well?" said the patrician.
"Not us," said Ridcully, his voice hollow. The patrician followed his gaze. The knife was already curved like a bow. The patrician scanned the sheepish crowd until he found Captain Doxy of the City Guard Day Watch.
"Can't you do something?"
he said. Like what, sir? The knife? I suppose I could arrest it for being bent?" Lord Vetinari threw his hands up in the air.
"So it's not magic. It's not gods. It's not people. What is it? And who's going to stop it? Who am I going to call?"
Half an hour later, the little globe had vanished. No one noticed. They never do. Mrs. Cake knew who she was going to call.
"You there, one man, Bucket?" she said.
Then she ducked, just in case. A reedy and petulant voice oozed out of the air.
"Where have you been? Can't move in here."
Mrs. Cake bit her lip. Such a direct reply meant her spirit guide was worried. When he didn't have anything on his mind, he spent 5 minutes talking about buffaloes and great white spirits. Although if One Man Bucket had ever been near white spirit, he'd drunk it, and it was anyone's guess what he'd do to a buffalo. And he kept putting ums and hows into the conversation.
"What do you mean?"
"There has been a catastrophe or something. Some kind of 10-second plague."
"No, don't think so."
"There's real pressure here, you know. What's holding everything up?"
"What do you mean?"
"Shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up. I'm trying to talk to the lady. You lot over there, keep the noise down. Oh, yeah? Said's you."
Mrs. Cake was aware of other voices trying to drown him out.
"One Man Bucket."
"Heathen savage, am I? So you know what this heathen savage says to you?" "Yeah. Listen, I've been over here for 100 years, me. I don't have to take talk like that from someone who's still warm." "Right, that does it. You..."
His voice faded. Mrs. Cake set her jaw. His voice came back.
Oh, yeah, well, maybe you was big when you was alive, friend, but here and now you're just a bedsheet with holes in it. Oh, so you don't like that, eh?"
"Oh, he's going to start fighting again, Mum," said Ludmilla, who was curled up by the kitchen stove. "He always calls people friend just before he hits them." Mrs. Cake sighed. "And it sounds as if he's going to fight a lot of people," said Ludmilla.
"Oh, all right, go and fetch me a vase, a cheap one, mind.